And a good morning to each of you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Chris Grote, along with
J.J. Hendricks.
And we are your Friday crew
here on
Mornings for the Master. And I tell you what, have you checked out what we're going to be talking about today? A lot of judgment today.
Judgment. We're going to be laying down some judgment. And that judgment ain't from us. That judgment is from God.
That's right. Judgment of Babylon. Judgment of Babylon. You got the restoration of Jacob, the judgment of Moab. And anyway, so you want to get your Bibles. We're going to be turning over to Isaiah chapter 13. Isaiah chapter 13 will be where we start today. But first, this. Announcements. Brotherhood events.
You're first, because it starts today.
All right. Down there in Cleburne, Texas, at the Granberry Street Church of Christ, Marriage and Family Seminar, what everybody needs, what every family needs, starting today, September 15th through the 17th, with John and Carla Moore.
Aren't they great?
John and Carla are fantastic. They have served in ministry for over 30 years. He and Carla work currently with the Bear Valley Bible Institute International and serve as directors of Bible Passages, a ministry dedicated to the defending of faith. And a lot of that Bible passage, you know, they're going back over to Israel. And, you know, they're helping us to get a glimpse of the Bible lands. If you haven't seen their Bible Land Passages website, we're going to go there and check that out. But together, you know, they've raised their three sons, all faithful. They serve the Lord. They've recently welcomed their first grandchild. And if you're friends with them on Facebook, man, you can watch them interact with those grandchildren. They are just, it's a great time of life for John and Carla. But anyway, what's going on? With this marriage family seminar, a lot of times, you know, it's just couples. They actually want you to bring your children. There'll be child care available for ages 1 through 3. But they want you to bring your children because they want them to hear these lessons as well. They will plant the seeds of what Bible teaching is on families. And so you've got your first general assembly tonight at 7. To 7:50, they'll be talking about the Prince of Peace. There'll be breakout sessions from 8 to 9. Then there'll be men and women's classes, tools for relationship building. And then on Saturday, they'll have a general assembly again, beginning at 9:30, a lesson on love that never ends. You'll have your breakout sessions for men and women at 10:45, and then they'll be talking about death to destructive habits. So anyway, and then, of course, Sunday, they want you to join them for Bible class at 9 a.m. at the Granberry Street Church of Christ in Cleburne, Texas. For more information, call them at 817-517-7713. That is 817-517-7713. All right, JJ, what do we have next?
The Camp Ida open house is going to be out at Camp Ida Saturday, September 23rd. And John McCormack is the guest speaker. It's 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. I saw a picture. Chris McElyea showed me a picture of something they have done at the camp.
You're not going to do any spoilers, are you?
Not doing any spoilers, but I didn't think they were doing that this year. But it's done. Did you see the pictures?
I saw the pictures. Jim Emery showed me to it. It really is going to be neat. You'll have to go out there to find out more. But you're in for a treat if you are a Camp Ida supporter listening to us right now. We want you out there at this open house if possible. Tell us how to get out there. What are the information and how you get out there, address and so forth? They have that on the flyer.
What you do is you get over to Mod, Texas, and you go out to 50 CR, our County Road 1207, and that's where they say Camp Ida is. And Google actually has Camp Ida in their program.
So when you get out, when you get to Maud, you know, if you're, they're going to be on the south end of town, just south of the Church of Christ building there. There's a road that goes to Minton, towards Minton. And you go down that road a little ways and until you get to County Road 1207.
You planning on going to this?
Yes, sir. Babaruski.
That's our plan as well. If something comes up, we might not be able to. But what I like about this picture, it's got the original cabins in the logo. So.
Sure enough. All right, Ladies' Day. Make me a servant.
These cabins now, man. The air conditioning is amazing.
Make me a servant is the theme for the Ladies' Day at the North Main Church of Christ this September 23rd. This is in Malvern, Arkansas. 823 North Main Street in Malvern, Arkansas. With speaker Lisa Harris. Registration is at 9 a.m. and lessons and everything kick off at 9:30. Lunch is provided. You're asked to RSVP by call or text to Amanda at 225-326-9179. And even though this is supposed to have been done by September 1st, I'm sure that they would not turn anybody away. They just want to make sure they have enough food for everybody. So September 23rd, people, is coming up quick. You can also call 501-332-2273. Or email the North Main Church of Christ at northmaincoc@gmail.com. Visit their website at malvernchurchofchrist.org.
All right, and Sunday the 24th, Sunday, September 24th, beginning Sunday, September 24th, the flyers are a little confusing, is John Moore, again, doing a marriage seminar this weekend. Get a couple little bit of time, and he's going to be out at the Love Lady Church of Christ, and he's going to be doing a gospel meeting on the Bible land passages, and it looks really neat. There's a reason to believe, Bible and archaeology, walking where David walked, walking where Jesus walked, I mean, he's got two different points on that, but it looks really good. How far away are we from Love Lady?
Well, you know, it's a few hours. It's probably 2-3 hours down there.
Oh, maybe they'll record it.
Well, you know, it's south of Palestine. Let's put it that way. So,
that's a ways.
Depends on how far you want to go to drive to go, and it would be worth the drive to go.
Yeah, John's Finn, just a great guy.
All right, and then last thing on our list this morning is the Back to the Bible lectures, October 14th through 15th. This will be at the Park Heights Church of Christ there in Hamilton, Texas, just south of Stephenville. The number to call is 254-386-3953. Again, that number is 254-386-3953. And it'll feature speakers Mel Hutzler. You know, I knew Mel Hutzler. He was a graduate of Southwest. And I think his first work was, it may have been that he was a youth minister over at the Eastern Hills Church in Marshall. And that was a congregation that supported me in preaching school. And so that's when I first met him. In fact, when the North Jefferson Church of Christ was just getting on its feet, meeting over at the Civic Center in Mount Pleasant during that time of transition, Mel Hutzler was commissioned to come over and help preach for our congregation. So he was one of its first preachers, especially as we consider them getting organized over at the Civic Center. But Mel Hutzler will be preaching on Saturday, October 14th at 2 p.m., Christ the Good Shepherd. Carl McCann, our neighbor, will preach at 3 o'clock, Christ is the Head of the Church. Tim Burrows will preach at 4 p.m., Christ is our Passover. And Johnny McCarron, love that man, 5 o'clock, he'll be preaching on Christ our High Priest. On Sunday, Joshua Moore will preach Christ is the Word, followed by Brian Braswell, Christ is our Example. So,
man, that's a good lineup.
Yes, six fantastic Christian men. All the recordings will be done by Tolstar, so that means they will be online.
All right.
We won't have to miss out on it in that way.
Josh Moore... we got to spend some time with him at Discipleship University, and he went to, of course, his dad was there in Malvern, and so he grew up in Malvern, so we got to compare stories. Our high schools were rivals. We weren't in high school at the same time. We just missed each other, but we got to talk about our high school rivalry a little bit, and just a real neat guy.
Well, I'll tell you what, he's a fine young man doing great work in the Lord. And well, I'm so proud of all those people. And I love that area over there around De Leon and Hyco and Stephenville and just a great area, good bunch of Christian people and good congregations.
What about Lampasas?
I'm sure lampasas is good. You know, I don't
know. I just wanted to say it. That's a really fun word.
I just don't know anybody over there.
Lampasas.
Lampasas. You know, the guy that baptized me into Christ was from Lampasas.
Lampasas.
Lampasas. So, all right. Well, let's dig into the Word of God today. JJ, lead us off. What are we dealing with here in chapter 13 of Isaiah?
All right, we're going to be looking at the judgment of Babylon. At least that is what the headline of the chapter says.
It is. It's actually, and, when you think of chapters 13 and 14 together, we can think of this as not just the judgment of Babylon, but also of Assyria and Philistia.
So what we're going to look at is the judgment that goes on there, and a little bit lets us know that there's going to be a restoration of Jacob. And that's going to be the beginning of chapter 14. So, how are we going to do this today, Chris? Are we going to read through, or
I tell you what, let's take it in sections. It might be better off for us to do that way. If you look at chapter 13, verses 1-22, that's just the chapter. Let's start with that first, and that's the destruction that is foretold about Babylon.
All right, the
destruction foretold. So let's do that. And then what we can do is when we go back and talk about it, we can break it up into sections.
All right.
So let's start there, and you read till you get tired, and I'll finish it want me to.
I'll high five you. I'll tag you.
Okay. Mighty good.
Me. Okay. The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw. On a bare hill, raise a signal, cry aloud to them. Wave the hand for them to enter the gates of the nobles. I myself have commanded my consecrated ones, and have summoned my mighty men to execute my anger, my proudly exulting ones. The sound of tumult is on the mountains, as of a great multitude, the sound of an uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathering together. The Lord of hosts is mustering a host for battle. They come from a distant land, from the end of the heavens, the Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Wait, for the day of the Lord is near. As destruction from the Almighty, it will come. Therefore, all hands will be feeble, and every heart will melt. They will be dismayed. Pangs and agony will seize them. They will be in anguish like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at one another. Their faces will be aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land of desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark as its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pomp of the arrogant, and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. I will make people more rare than fine gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken out of its place, as at the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the days of the fierce anger. Of his fierce anger, and like a hunted gazelle or sheep with none to gather them, each will turn to his own people, and each will flee to his own land. Whoever is found will be thrust through, and whoever is caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed in pieces before their eyes, their houses will be plundered, and their wives ravished. Behold, I am stirring up the Medes against them, who have no regard for silver and do not delight in gold. Their bows will slaughter the young men. They will have no mercy on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes will not pity children. In Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the splendor and the pomp of the Chaldeans will be like Sodom and Gomorrah when God overthrew them. It will never be inhabited or lived in for all generations. No Arab will pitch his tent there. No shepherds will make their flocks lie down there. But wild animals will lie down there, and their houses will be full of howling creatures. Their ostriches will dwell, and there wild goats will dance. Hyenas will cry in its towers, and jackals in the pleasant palaces. Its time is close at hand, and its days will not be prolonged.
All right, so the desolation is so great, nobody will live there, just wild animals. And who did he say in verse number 17 was going to inflict the...
The Medes.
All right. You know, we, of course, we know them along with the Medes and the Persians, mm-hmm. one of the great kingdoms that will come up to do execute the will of God. Well, let's start back at the beginning again and just kind of muddle through what we've got here. The destruction is foretold in this chapter. We notice in verses 6 through 16, the severity of that destruction. Notice again in verses 6 through 8, all the people will be paralyzed with fear as God destroys Babylon. Wait, for the day of the Lord is near, as destruction from the Almighty will come. Therefore, all hands will be feeble. Every human heart will melt. Every human heart will melt. They will be dismayed. Pangs and agony will seize them. They will be in anguish like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at one another. Their faces will be aflame. Notice the shock and the surprise and the stress, the anxiety that they're going to feel.
Oh, they think they're on top of the world right now. World power. They think that they're going to continue to grow and that they're going to never see any downtime. They're never going to be that they're never going to falter. And
so
they're going to be super, super surprised.
Yes, and paralyzed with fear. Notice in verse number 9, the land will be devastated and the people will be destroyed. Now, you see in the Bible, the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord. Anytime you see the day of the Lord, it's always a significant date, all right? Whenever that happens, it's a time when judgment is going to take place. Now, you can see that there are times like in Acts chapter 2 where Joel prophesies the great and notable day, all right? Well, it's not a judgment day there, but it's a significant change in events, something so different. And notice how the poetic language of prophecy paints the picture. The stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. That's an expression that it's not literal. You know, we still have the stars today, but that is, it's as if you were to think of it in literal terms, how catastrophic that would be.
Mm-hmm.
That's this day of the Lord. This is this judgment that's going to happen to this people. All right, you got to think of it in terms of metaphorical terms. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. That's like in Joel talking about Acts chapter 2. The sun shall be turned into darkness, and the moon into blood, before the great and notable day of the Lord come. So you know that figure of speech. Again, think about it. The stars aren't going to shine. The sun ain't going to shine. The moon ain't going to shine.
The stars at night won't be big and bright. Clap, 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 clap.
Exactly. So you've got this Hebrewistic language that is supposed to tell you this is a big, fat, hairy deal event. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And what's going to happen is I'm going to put an end to the pomp and the arrogance and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. I circle that verse in my Bible because God can't stand that attitude in anybody. And when a nation has that pride and that pomp, it's just a matter of time before God humbles them. Now, how he does it through natural means. God says he raised up the Medes to judge the Babylon, but how he pulled all of his strings, he allowed that nation to rise somehow and come against it. And so behind the scenes, you know, what looked like one nation just ganging up on another, time and circumstance, happened to all people. This oracle, which is a prophecy of Amos, I'm sorry, which Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw, is actually telling you behind the scenes, God has orchestrated all that.
Mm-hmm.
So
we rise and we fall.
Yeah. And so I'm led to believe that when things like that happen today, that somehow, you know, God's in control, which means he's pulling the strings and doing something up there in his heaven that, you know, we don't have an oracle to know exactly how he's doing it. Or that he's, you know, particularly pushed the button on a thing. But I know that that is his ways of the past. And I can, it says in verse number 12, I will make people more rare than fine gold. In other words, those people are going to die. He's going to clear out this land. And so you keep seeing in like verse number 13, the wrath of the Lord, the day of his fierce anger. You're going to see that throughout the chapters because God is actually mad. You know, we saw where the heavens will be darkened. No light will shine. Survivals will be scarce as gold. Babylon's armies, verse 14, will flee to their own lands like hunted deer. If you look at verses number 15 and 16, the children will be killed and the wives raped. That's a horrible picture. Everyone who is caught will be run through with a sword, and all their homes will be sacked.
And that's a big deal, because basically what we're finding is that their land is going to be destroyed. I find it similar. Before we got on the air, I said I wanted to talk about Obadiah a little bit, but I know we're going to be talking about Moab a little bit in a minute. But one of the things that was so key about Moab's destruction was that the young men were going to be killed, and if you weren't killed, you were going to be taken to the border. And that wasn't being taken to Taco Bell. That was being taken to another country to be assimilated. That means that they were taken to another place and made to fall in line with their history and their traditions, and that Moab history was going to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And Babylon's going to find the same thing. We're going to kill your kids. We're going to take your wives. We're going to kill the men. People are going to be scarce. We might send other people in there so that even your traditions are going to be gone, as different people are going to be living there. So basically it's going to be as if you never were. I mean, they'll be able to dig stuff up with history, but they're not going to have anything to really look back on and say, hey, look at your history. So this is going to be just an out-and-out utter destruction.
This is a destruction of Babylon. Now, this is Daniel's time period, mm-hmm. when you think about it, because Daniel is in Babylon. And then there's the chapter where the Medes and the Persians takes over. Darius was the son of Ahasuerus by descendant a Mede, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. So, you know, you've got that that image of that Daniel showed you in the book of Daniel, and you knew when the Medes and the Persians were going to take over. I mean, you didn't know a date, but you knew that they were going to at some point. So this is Isaiah is prophesying of something that Daniel also prophesied about as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, Obadiah prophesied about it, too, because basically what you end up finding is God used Babylon to punish his people. And whenever you talk about drinking from the cup, whenever you see that, oftentimes what that means is punishment. And while Israel drank from the cup, that Moab and Babylon and all of them were going to drink it to the bottom, which means they were going to find complete and utter destruction. So while God used Moab, or God used Babylon to discipline his people,
mm-hmm.
they were going to be punished too, because even though he used them to punish his people, they were still wrong.
Right,
so they were going to have their comeuppance, and that's something that that Israel was going to be able to see.
Now, let me make one more observation, and you might have something else you want to say about this chapter. But in verse number 11, it says, "I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity." Now, I'm going to punish the world. That's a big scope there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to understand that God's covenant people aren't the only ones in this purview. You know, God is going to judge all nations. All people will be judged by him. And I think the emphasis the Bible puts on the word wicked and wickedness is tremendously important. Their emphasis is on is very conspicuous in Proverbs. The noun wickedness occurs like 27 times in the periods of biblical history for the Hebrews. Judges 20, Deuteronomy 13, Deuteronomy 15, 19. Wicked occurs about 260 times in the Testament. Both words carry the idea of wrongdoing. And the wicked are described as a category of people who have not just done wrong, but are still living in sin, who are intent on continuing with wrongdoing. They have no penitent heart. And I know in some cases, I mean, we have to understand that all have sinned and come short of glory of God, and that even Christians are sinners who have been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. Now, that doesn't make us in the sinners category, even though we have sin. That word sinners a lot of times is, well, in fact, almost every time. You know, even the publican said, "Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner," because he committed sin. But when the Bible uses the word sinners a lot of time, or the wicked, it's talking about a group of people who are, yes, sinners, but are impenitent.
Yeah, the unrepentant.
The unrepentant. There's a whole class that we need to take into consideration. And not Christians who struggle against sin and have to ask for forgiveness often don't need to feel the pressure, just because they want to be humble in the sight of God, don't need to feel the pressure to lump themselves into the category of the impenitent sinners.
Right.
But that's all I'm trying to say, is that there is a group, a class, a distinction of people that do commit sin and have no intention of repenting. They have no intention of trying to do anything right, and that's these people that we're talking about right here.
Oh, absolutely.
I think we just need to put that out there, because
God used them, and they even had people like David and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They had good examples, and Babylon could have been like Nineveh, where they turned to God, but we're going to find that they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we don't know how everything worked. There might have been a chance they could have, but it was their hardened hearts, and they're gonna pay the cost for that. And so we're going to see that ends chapter 13. We see what's going to happen. I like the example here, the ostriches, the hyenas, the jackals. And what that leads me to believe is, I remember watching a documentary on the Discovery Channel years ago, and basically it was what would happen if mankind just evaporated. What would happen to the world? And part of it is animals would come into the cities that they don't come into now because they're afraid of humans, and they would eat the food that we've left over, and that they would live in our palaces, basically, because we weren't there. It wouldn't be a palace to them, but they're going to live there because it's safe. And eventually it's going to overgrow with grass. So when I see this thing about jackals and hyenas and ostriches, I'm sure there's something that we can look at deeper with that. But basically I see they're going to be gone, and they're going to be gone with such ferocity that people aren't going to return, and the animals are going to take over. The animals are just going to be around.
And that's what will happen.
Yeah.
Let me say this. We're going to go on to chapter 14. But keep in mind, in chapter 14, one of the first things we start off with here is we get a break from the judgment of God, and we get into the mercy of God. God does have compassion on his friends and on people that fear him, okay? So what does that say in verses 1 through 2?
1 through 2. I may tag you out into verse 2, so.
Okay.
Joking. For the Lord will have compassion on Jacob, and will again choose Israel, and will set them in their own land. And sojourners will join them, and will attach themselves to the house of Jacob. And the peoples will take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them in the Lord's hand, land as male and female slaves. They will take captive those who were their captors, and rule over those who oppressed them.
All right, so in this, we've got the salvation and the sarcasm. In verses 1 through 3, God promises to forgive, restore, and resettle his people in their land forever. Verse number 3 says, "When the Lord has given you rest from your pain and turmoil and the hard service with which you were made to serve, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon."
Here's what I got from it. You can tell me if I'm wrong, and I might be. Is, "For the Lord will have compassion on Jacob, and again choose Israel, and will set them in their own land, and sojourners will join them, and will attach themselves to the house of Jacob." We see under the law of Moses what it takes, what you're supposed to do to sojourners. And then down here it says they will take him as slaves. Basically, what I'm pulling from this is that the Babylonians are going to be so defeated that they're going to be kind of like the prodigal son in a way that he's like, if I could just eat the pig food. Basically, they're saying, if you will let me be your slave, I'll be happy. So it's not that Israel is going to be taking them as slaves by force. I believe what this is saying is they will basically ask them, can we be your slaves so we don't die?
Yeah, yeah, they're begging for their lives. Now, let's
because
do
this. We see this right here. The sojourners will join them, will attach themselves to the house of Jacob, and the people will take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them in the Lord's hand as male and female slaves.
Mm-hmm.
That's not them going and warring. That is them. It says attach themselves to Jacob. That's why I'm coming to the conclusion. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's the conclusion I'm coming to, is it's not Israel actively fighting against them. It's that they are going to actively say, please let us be your slaves or we will die from hunger, because there were rules that the law of Moses put in that you were to take care of sojourners and servants.
No, you're absolutely right. That they would become their slaves.
Say that one more time. Mm. Mm.
Well, so, no, I'm not going to do that. So, verse 23 is kind of a good chapter break here. Here's what Albert Barnes says about this chapter. He gives a synopsis about chapter 14, which I think is worthy of our notation today. He says, this chapter is a continuation of the prophecy respecting Babylon, which was commenced in the previous chapter. The prophecy is concluded in verse 27. A considerable portion of this chapter is a poem of unequaled beauty and sublimity. It will be remembered that this prophecy was uttered at least 174 years before they were carried into captivity, and the design of the prophet is to declare the certainty of their release after they should be subjected to this bondage. He doubtless intended that this prophecy should be borne with them in memory, at least to Babylon, and that it should comfort them as they march forward into into the fulfillment of this prophecy in history. So, if you look at that verse number 4, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. So, what does he say in verse number 4?
How the oppressor has ceased, the insolent fury ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers that struck the people in wrath with unceasing blows and ruled the nations in anger with unrelenting persecution. The whole earth is at rest and quiet. They break forth into singing. The cypresses rejoice at you, the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no woodcutter comes up against us. Sheol beneath is stirred up to meet you when you come. It rouses the shades to greet you, all who are leaders of the earth. It raises from their thrones all who were kings of the nations. All of them will answer and say to you, you too have become as weak as we. You have become like us. Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, the sound of your harps. Maggots are laid as a bed beneath you, and worms are your covers. How you are fallen from heaven, O Star of David, Son of Dawn. How you are cut down to the ground. You who laid the nations low, you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you were brought down to Sheol, to the far reaches of the pit. Those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities, who did not let his prisoners go home? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. But you are cast out, away from your grave, like a loathed branch clothed with the slain, who's pierced by the sword, who go down to the stones of the pit, like a dead body trampled underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial, because you have destroyed your land. You have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers never more be named. prepare slaughter for his sons because of their guilt of their fathers, lest they rise and possess the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and will cut off from Babylon name and remembrant descendants and posterity, says the Lord, and I will make it a possession of the hedgehog and pools of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord of hosts.
Let's go back to verse number 12 and take note of something right there, because some people have the King James, no doubt, and they'll probably be asking this question. Read that verse 12 again.
All right. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn.
What is that in the King James? Do you know?
No.
Lucifer.
Lucifer.
Lucifer. What do you think people associate with Lucifer?
Satan.
Yeah. The context is not about Satan, is it?
Mm-mm.
It's about the king of Babylon. And I know this is going to throw some people off, because the tradition has been that Lucifer is Satan, that's his name, Lucifer. A lot of people call Lucifer Satan. But this is not about Satan. It's not about him at all. It's about the king of Babylon.
But, I mean, if you read it, like, it sounds kind of like Satan. I mean, it's not Satan, but I could understand why somebody could confuse it.
Well, I do too, but it's simply not so.
Right.
The existence of the devil has got to be explained, but I don't think this verse does it. We're talking about a fallen person, not a fallen angel. And this person is said to have fallen from heaven, which to many is the explanation for the origin of Satan. But further proof of this passage is often connected with Luke 10, verse number 18. I beheld Satan fallen as lightning from heaven. You know, they look at this and they think, okay, well, this has got to be the same thing. But neither passage is really proof of the devil's origin, because that's the use of like or as. You know, so it's a simile to begin with. And you can't make anything that's a simile be an exact representation of what really happened. The point here seems to be the comparison of an earthly monarch, which in the context here in Isaiah is a Babylonian king with the bright morning star. The comparison of a monarch with the sun or the other heavenly bodies is common in Scripture. Even Barnes agrees with that. Haley says that Isaiah is likening the Babylonian to a brilliant star whose glory is cut down by a fall from the height of heaven to the ground. Adam Clark says the text speaks nothing at all concerning Satan or his fall, nor the occasion of that fall, which many divines have with great confidence deduced from this text. So I look at least three old school, even denominational commentators, who all three of them agree that this is not talking about Satan. So what we need to understand is the meaning of the word Lucifer, and it means day star. So anyway, I just wanted to point that out for just a moment. And I noticed the things which are said about this fallen person as we summarize. Number one, he did weaken the nations, verse number 12. Number two, he would ascend into heaven, verse number 13. Verse number 13 says, you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north. Now, that's not heaven. This is just the idea that he wants to ascend and become great. His throne exalted above the stars of God. All right, look at that. Verse number 13, above the stars of God, I will set my throne on high. This is stuff he says he's going to do. He would sit upon the mount of the congregation, verse number 13. The Mount of Assembly. He would ascend above the clouds, verse number 14. In verse number 14, he would be like the Most High. So this sounds kind of like the tradition that we've heard about Satan wanting to elevate himself. I understand that. He would be brought down to hell or to Sheol, verse number 7. So we're talking about his pride, and God's going to take his pride. He's going to abase him. All right. Verse number 16, he would be seen as dead by passersby. Now, that's where it gets to be more earthly. All right. Verse number 17, he made the world a wilderness. He destroyed cities. He kept prisoners in prison. Now, that's if that's more literal, then that's going to be more this king, not Satan. He would be cast out of this grave, verse 19. Well, Satan doesn't have a grave. All right? People do.
Yeah, Satan all right? doesn't. He's all right? not a physical, I mean, not a...
physical person.
Yeah.
All right. He would be denied an honorable burial. Satan doesn't have a body to have a burial. All right? That's verse 20. Verse 20 says he had destroyed land and slain people. Now, Satan does spiritually influence the destruction of people. But destroying land and slaying people, this is what a human king did. All right, his name, this monarch, look at verse number 22. Verse number 22, I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, will cut off from Babylon the name and remnant, descendants and posterity, declares the Lord, of this Babylonian king. And so his name was to become extinct. Of the many interpretations which we have been given to the fallen power and the works that followed him, one is that he is an individual king. Another is that the reference is to a description of a dynasty that would cease or become extinct. And so the inevitable fate of Babylon is that it will become a possession for the porcupine. Possession in the pools of water is what does it say here in verse number 23? And I will sweep it with the broom of destruction.
I like that. The broom of destruction.
Mm. It's like the cup of wrath, a broom of destruction. You know, you got all these wonderful, metaphorical concepts to help paint the picture. God's going to go in with a clean sweep.
Clean sweep. Just sweep and. It's like no effort from God, really. I mean, he is the ultimate
I got to do is say the word.
So all he's got to do is say the word. Just a simple sweep as we would sweep dust out of our house.
All right. What chapter are we supposed to go to today in our...
17.
17, man. We've got to get cracking, man. We've got to get cracking. Guys, well, let's go to the... very quick, let's summarize what's going on in chapter 14. Chapter 14 basically is the judgment of Philistia. And you've got the warning.
We got Assyria in here too.
Yeah, you've got the warning. God tells Philistia that Philistia not to rejoice over death of its terrible oppressor, for his son will prove to be an even greater scourge. That's in verses 18 through 30, 28 through 30, and in verses 31 through 32, wail, O gate, cry out, O city, melt in fear, O Philistia, all of you. For smoke comes out of the north, and there is no straggler in his ranks. What will one answer the messengers of the nation? The Lord has founded Zion, and in her the afflicted of his people find refuge. And so there will be weeping. The Philistines will soon begin wailing, for their nation is doomed.
Doomed.
Okay. And then there was that oracle concerning concerning Assyria in verses 24 through... through verse 27. So let's go to chapter 15.
Going to be concerning Moab. We got a lot of destruction of Moab promises in the Bible. Jeremiah talks about it. Isaiah talks about it. Obadiah is dedicated dedicated to Edom. But we see principles that lie in there, in that these people that were cruel to God's people are not going to enjoy the judgment. We see things like verse 7, therefore the abundance they have gained and what they have laid up they carry away over the brook of the willows, for a cry has gone around the land of Moab. Her wailing reaches Eglaim, and her wailing reaches to Beer Elam. For the waters of Dibon are full of blood, for I will bring upon Dibon even more a lion for those of Moab who escape. So Moab is going to be assimilated.
Okay, so... the suffering of Moab, if you'll notice verses 1 and verse 9 of chapter 15, just start the first and look at the last. Because Ar of Moab is laid waste in the night, Moab is undone. Moab is undone. That is said twice in that verse. There's two key cities there. There's Ar and there's Ker. They're going to be destroyed in one night, the Bible says. If you look at verse number 9, for the waters of Dibon are full of blood, for I will bring upon Dibon even more a lion for those of Moab who escape, for the remnant of the land. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land. Okay, so, you know, we've got this, in verse number 9, the streams will run with blood is the lions are going to hunt down the survivors and the streams are going to run with blood. I'm sure that's a figurative statement, but I'm sure that there's some element of truth to that.
Right.
You know, I mean, literal. And to think of it in literal terms, I just don't think it's like when it was in Egypt and they turned the water to blood, you know. But anyway, somebody might think of it more literally. But I do think of it as a figure of speech in that sense. If you jump to chapter 16 and look at verses 1 through 5, we're still talking about the suffering of Moab. The women will be abandoned like homeless birds. All right? They will cry out for help and for defense against their enemies, but they will find no help. Is what that says. Like fleeing birds in a scattered nest, so are the daughters of Moab, says verse number 2. All right. And then if you look at verses 13 through 14 of chapter 16, within 3 years, few of the people will be left alive. The glory of Moab will be ended. It's hard to understand that a nation like Moab had ever ascended to any kind of glory whatsoever. Whatever they had, God's bringing it down.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me. And then you look at the sin of Moab in chapter 16, verse number 6. What is the sin there?
We have heard the pride of Moab, how proud he is of his arrogance, his pride, and his insolence. In his idle boasting, he is not right.
So what's the sin there?
Pride.
What was the sin in the last chapter for Babylon?
Pride.
You know, if you really look at the theme here,
truth be told, if it's not God, it's pride. Because you never see a country that is a world power that isn't proud of their accomplishments. I mean, I'm sure you go back 100 years when Great Britain, like, ran half the world with colonies, that they didn't have some pride about them. I mean, imagine just even longer than 100 years ago with America, is they came over to teach these dumb farmhands a thing or two, and we didn't play by the rules of war, and there was the revolution, we won. So that had to have been a blow to the pride of Great Britain. So it's either you depend on God or you grow in pride. I mean, I don't see two ways about that. I mean,
well, it's just as I, when I think about my own person, myself, I'm thinking about the scriptures that say, you know, pride goes before a
fall.
You know, a haughty spirit before destruction.
I thought we were playing the game. I was getting into it there.
Yeah, I thought
you were giving me a fill in the blank. I'm like, boom, we're hitting this.
And you did it. You did it. And so I'm just sitting here thinking that what about Chris Grota? What about him?
Handsome.
Well, thank you, but I can't take that compliment and let it go to my head, can I? You know, that's the problem. And
the glory either goes to God or it goes to self.
So here, you know, there's nothing greater than to see a soul saved.
Absolutely.
If I teach the gospel to somebody obeys the gospel. It's one thing for me to say that I've begotten somebody in the Lord like Paul did, you know, that I might have a child in the faith or something like Paul said of Timothy or some of the other guys that he worked with. He called some of the Christians that he worked with his joy and his crown. You know, I mean, obviously he was pleased with the Christians that he helped go to heaven. At the same time, you know, Paul removed himself from a position of any kind of glory. He says, I know how to be abased. I know how to be exalted. I know how to be high. I know how to be low. You know, and so... rich and poor and all that kind of stuff. He helps us to understand where the line is, that it's not about us. And I think in a position, anytime you work in a position where you're in front of people, whether it's preaching or whether it's a company that you're a boss, a leadership of. Maybe you're in politics and you've got all these people working under you. Maybe you're in a position of authority. I think it can be very, very tempting to forget to be humble, and the Lord wants us to humble our own selves. He doesn't want to have to humble us. He wants us to humble ourselves before Him and before others that we might be lifted up. And so if I really want to be lifted up, if I really want the glory of the Lord in the end, I've got to be able to be that servant.
Right.
I've got to be able to bow myself.
That's why I say it's either one or the other.
And that's not what these people were doing.
Yeah, you either are understand it's by God or it is by self. And when you go by self, pride comes into play. So we have a choice, and that's why we should always choose to serve God, because we know where all this comes from. And it gets over to chapter 17 with Damascus. Verse 1, an oracle concerning Damascus. Behold, Damascus will cease to be a city and will become a heap of ruins. And it didn't happen because they were swell fellas.
Okay.
I mean, this was going to happen because of how rotten they were.
Okay, this is Aram in the Northern Kingdom, right? Chapter 17,
mm-hmm.
Right? So we're talking about the Northern Kingdom. And verses 1 through 6, 9 through 11 talks about the severity of this punishment. So I just want the listeners to know what we're talking about here.
All right. The cities of verse 2, the cities of are deserted. They will be for the flocks, which will lie down, and none will make them afraid. The fortress will disappear from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and a remnant of Syria will be like the glory of the children of Israel, declares the Lord of hosts. And in that day the glory of Jacob will be brought low, and fat of his flesh will grow lean, and it shall be as when the reaper gathers standing grain in his arms, harvesting the ears, and as the one who gleans the ears of grain in the valley of Rephaim. Gleanings will be left in it as when the olive tree is beaten, two or three berries on the top of the highest bow, four or five of the branches of the fruit tree, declares the Lord God of Israel.
So things are going to be pretty thin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In that day, and if you look at it, this is different than the others. The others, mm-hmm. complete destruction. Here, a couple berries. In that day, man.
This is more of a salvation concept here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In that day, man will look to his Maker, and the eyes will look on the Holy One of Israel. He will not look to the altars, the work of his hands. And he will not look at his own fingers have made, either the Asherim or the altars of incense. In that day their strong cities will be like the deserted places of the wooded heights and the hilltops which they deserted because of the children of Israel, and there will be desolation. For you have forgotten the God of your salvation, and have not remembered the rock of your refuge. Therefore, though you plant pleasant plants, and sow the vine branch of a stranger, though you may make them grow on the day that you plant them, and make them blossom in the morning that you sow, yet the harvest will flee away in a day of grief and incurable pain. Ah, the thunder of many people, they thunder like the thundering of the sea. Ah, the roar of nations, they roar like the roaring of mighty waters. The nation roar like the roaring of mighty waters, but he will rebuke them and they will flee far away. Chase like chaff on the mountain before the wind, and the whirling dust before the storm. At evening time, behold, air, before morning there no more. This is the portion of those who loot us, and the lot of those who plunder us.
You did a very good reading there.
Thank you.
You're doing great. Now, well, we've got just a few minutes. We've got a few minutes, and I just want to take these last few minutes to just take some time. Let's do a little reflection here. Now, something caught my eye when you read verses 7 and 8.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he says, "In that day, man will look to his Maker." Now, that's God.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and his eyes will look on the Holy One of Israel. The Holy One of Israel.
Well, we see that happen in destruction with people today is they're atheist until a family member gets sick.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's fantastic. If God can get them somehow.
Oh, and we've seen that happen before. Somebody gets a cancer scare, and all of a sudden they're at church every service, but when that cancer goes away, all of a sudden they're gone again.
And now, that's sad.
It is sad.
So what people need is a tragedy to live with.
Sometimes.
A thorn in their flesh.
But say, I hope I'm never that way, but some people do need that.
Well, okay, so he will not look to the altars. Oh, yeah, by the way, when Paul said that God sent a messenger of Satan to buffet him, he had to give him a thorn in the flesh. You remember why he said he needed that? It was so that he would not be exalted. Remember, he had seen the third heaven.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so
pride could come pretty easy.
And so to keep him humble, it was given to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think about that, if that's what was needed. He will not look to the altars, the work of his hands. He will not look on what his own fingers have made, either the ashram or the altars of incense. We're talking about idolatry here. In that day, their strong cities will be made like deserted places, and the wooded heights and the hilltops, which they deserted, deserted because of the children of Israel, and there was desolation. So, you know, you have forgotten the God of your salvation. Now, he says, because of this destruction, God will send something to help them remember the God of their salvation, to help him look to and remember his maker. And so the big lesson that I got throughout all of this is that pride is what led up to all these destructions.
Mm-hmm.
And attached to this pride was the self-made religion that man had made up for himself. And so I'm seeing not just a destruction of pride, but a destruction of idolatry as well in our life. What did you get out of it?
Same thing. I mean, you either choose God or you choose pride. And it's really hard to humble yourself without God. So I choose God.
Well, I want to choose God too. And I want to encourage each one of you that are listening today, I want you to evaluate self and think about whether or not you be in the faith. Let's not let our pride get in the way of our relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. Let's not let pride cause us to go to hell. For Mornings for the Master on Friday, I'm Chris Grote along with
J.J. Hendricks.
We want you to remember that we're
proud of you.
You've been listening to Mornings for the Master on the Gospel Radio Network. Remember to join us each weekday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Central Standard Time, or catch the replay at 9 p.m. Central Time. You can also contact us at mornings@tgrn.org if you have any questions we can help you with, or if you have events you would like to submit to our bulletin board, or just with general feedback about the program or network. We would love to hear from you. As we've had opportunity to spend time with the Master this morning in His Word, let's remember His words in Luke 6:46, when He said, "Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" He goes on to say in verse 47 and 48, "Whosoever cometh to me and heareth my sayings and doeth them, I will show to you whom he is like. He is like a man which built an house and digged deep and laid the foundation on a rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock." Let's show the wisdom of that builder and go now to live for the Master.